Welcome to the Critical Few Actions to Improve Your Business podcast. I'm John Downes, and I'm here to help you cut through the overwhelm and prioritize what matters most to improve your business. Let's get started and discover the critical few actions that have the biggest impact. Today, I'd like to introduce you to Yim Hyun, who I've known since 2019, and since then, she's helped a number of my successful CEOs to figure out how to tender for and win local, state, and federal government supply contracts. Yim, welcome.
Oh, thank you, John. It's a pleasure being on here, and thank you for the invitation to be on your podcast. I find your podcast amazing, full of information that helps lots of businesses, so I feel a bit privileged to be on your podcast today.
Well, it's a delight to have you. Now, in my 24 years in Deloitte, I wrote countless expressions of interest, requests for tender, statements of qualifications. And I also helped federal and state government manage tenders for things like identity document processing, traffic camera operations, and IT systems implementation. But it really is a dark art, and there are some essential things you absolutely have to get right to even have a chance of being successful. So if you're looking at getting into tendering to government or you want to improve your win rate, this is the thing you've got to listen to. So, Yim, today we're going to talk about how medium business founders and CEOs can become suppliers and service providers to government and even large corporates to increase their revenue and profitability. But first, tell me a bit about your government procurement journey. How did you first get interested and how did that journey evolve?
Well, thank you, John. That was a great summary of government and tendering and all the things that are involved in government buying. But in my 25 years of working, I've worked for big fours, large corporates and government. And it really is stemmed from how CEDO was born in working with government and seeing that government was missing out on an enormous amount of potential with SMEs and what was out there. So, you know, typically 20 to 30 years ago, government would always pick the big fours.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, things have evolved. We've got enormous innovation. We've got enormous skills and capabilities in all areas of products and services. And so that gap that government didn't understand helped us form CEDO of what it is today, in that we understand government, we understand the landscape, how government buys, and we really translate that back into industry and help SMEs really understand how it is to work with government, particularly that it's not just a contract, it's actually building long-standing partnerships through innovation and building on the Australian manufacturing services, products and goods, and retaining that within Australia.
Yeah, yeah. And in the context of medium business, is it simply a matter of watching tender search and applying for anything that looks meaty, and then government money will just rain down upon us?
We all wish money just rains down on us, and we all wish that government just throws money at us, but unfortunately that's not the case with government. They are very risk adverse governments. So what you see out on, you know, your typical tender.vic.gov site is really only 20% of actual tenders that the public really sees. And it's really around, if it's a very high profile, obviously it will go out to public, but it really is then designed the 80% on panels, within panels, closed panels, direct sourcing, and building those relationships to actually work with government. So companies who are unaware, or you know, SMEs are unaware that there's an enormous opportunity out there that they actually don't see. And to help them, it's really understanding the panels that they need to be on and what government needs and what government buys to enable them to find those panels.
And probity is such an important thing for government. I mean, we talk about the pub test. 20 years ago, we used to think about, you know, what's the most important thing for government, and that is not to appear on the front page of the Age or the Herald Sun. And that's really one of the big tests around, okay, can we stand behind our process so that we have been fair and diligent and good custodians of the public's money they're spending on our behalf? And I've got to say, having worked with the public sector for at least 15 years earlier in my career, you know, they take this seriously. They're very professional. Yes, you'll always find anyone can take cheap shots at government, but they really they do understand this concept of public service is a servant of the public, to serve the public. So I've actually got an enormous amount of respect for those who work in the public service on our behalf.
Absolutely. Probity is so important because it really is, you know, figuring out what's right, what's wrong, and really you're responsible for the community's money, right? So we all pay our taxes, we all pay our rates, and it's equally important that it's been spent right. So, you know, approving, you know, my cousin next door for a contract isn't the way that government likes to do things. And, you know, those probity things are in place so that it's fair and equitable for all SMEs and all partners who wish to work with government to actually procure and go through the right path. I recently did a workshop, and one of the key questions that someone did ask is probity. And how do they navigate probity? There isn't really a definitive answer of how to navigate probity. Probity is there in place to protect you. It's also there to protect the government in making ill-informed decisions based on their relationships or conflicts and whatnot and third parties. But one of the things that I did say is you can't go and have a coffee and ask about that. So about the procurement, because it's unfair to the person who's also tendering that they're not getting the information the same way. So, and government now, you can't go and have a drink down the pub. And what you said, the pub test, it doesn't exist anymore. Mm. And that's like because they're managing their risk, because it's important, because things have happened in the past where a lot of people's names were on the Herald Sun, and that's what you don't want to be. And so now they're protecting themselves to be a bit more risk averse around probity, and it's important that they do that. So when you're building relationships with a government agency, which is usually what you're fine to do, but as soon as that procurement comes out to the public and it's actually issued, it's where the probity line draws. So you can speak to them about, you know, if you're the incumbent, you can speak to them about what you're doing on a daily basis, but at no circumstances are they obligated to talk to you about the procurement that's actually been released. So, and I think people need to learn to respect that at the very least.
Well, you know, that's a really important point, because actually the probity works to protect you both. You know, often people sort of think, okay, probity is just to protect the government so that they can stay off the front page of the papers and that they can actually defend what they've done. And to a large extent, that's absolutely true. But the second part of that is the probity process actually protects you as the bidder or as the potential incumbent. And, you know, we saw over the last 18 months, there was a Senate inquiry into the big seven consulting houses, which actually raised the question as to how could they grow so dramatically in size? Was it just purely because government had a lack of capability? Or was there breaches of probity, independence, conflicts of interest, and so on? And that certainly destroyed a lot of work going into the large consulting houses, as it was appropriate to do. And so I see that probity is a really essential part of this process, because it protects not only government, but it protects us from actually potentially costly errors, which may be completely inadvertent.
Absolutely. So, I can agree.
So, Yim, I remember this whole process quite well. I'm actually having flashbacks now, and I'll go and sit in a corner and suck my thumb in a minute. But so Once a procurement document, request for tender or request for information, has been released to the market, what should a medium business do?
One of the tips that we do when we run workshops to educate industry is read the document. So, and I can't say that explicit enough, because everybody assumes they read, but read the documents in full and in detail. Like, spend the time to sit there and read the four parts, because, you know, government tenders, there is always four parts.
Yeah.
Read them, particularly around the mandatory requirements, because that should give you the opportunity to really do a bid or no bid. A lot of people don't do bids or no bids. They dive right into saying, oh, yes, this is exactly what we want. But as you read through the details and as you read through the mandatory, if you can't pass the first gate, they're not going to look at it. So it's been the last few years in running procurements for government, it's been ruthless. So there are so many responses that government have to evaluate. And one of the mechanisms that they do to help them sift through the shortlisted is mandatory requirements. So if it's asking you for a cybersecurity policy, have a cybersecurity policy. If it's asking you for insurance for the value of $20 million, have those insurance requirements in place. Without them, you've just lost the first gate. You're going nowhere. Yeah, absolutely. So you're allowing your competitors to take advantage of the situation by you not having it.
And I must admit, I often think back to when I was doing studying economics in high school, getting prepared for my HSC exams. And I remember one of my teachers, lovely guy, and he was also an examiner. And the thing that he sort of repeated himself on all through that final year at school was, read the damn question. And that's actually stuck with me now for the following 40 plus years. But it's just such an essential part because, those documents aren't put together carelessly.
No.
They are crafted with great diligence, and every word has earned its right to be in the damn document. And so if you're not looking very carefully at those selection criteria and the weighting criteria and the mandatory things, then you won't even get to the first gate, and you will have wasted potentially weeks or months of work for no point.
Absolutely. It is expensive. Like tendering and responding to a tender, depending on the size, is a very expensive process. It's a lot of time commitment that you've got to give to actually put up a really worthy response for you to be shortlisted or potentially be the preferred supplier. So, mandatory requirements, yes, you pass that gate, but read the questions. So, in the response document, read the question. So, if
Absolutely.
they this is what they want, tell them what they want. But stick to the word limits. We've redacted responses from
Yeah.
the government's behalf. If they've said 300 and you've written a war and peace of 1,000 pages, we
Too
literally
bad.
have to go to the 300 words and we redact the rest. So you've lost a whole page and a half of selling yourself because you didn't listen. And you can't be complacent of saying, oh, that's word limits. It doesn't matter. It actually does matter. And it really is important that you do that. And when you tell you to do something, just do it.
Well, it's about establishing a level playing field. I remember that sort of stuff was so crucial when we stopped bidding for work that wasn't right for us, or that we had no hope of winning. And then what,
Absolutely. And one of the key things that we tell people to look at is, when you do your bid or no bid is, do you fit the requirement? Can you actually deliver on those requirements? Yes or no? Do you have a relationship or do you know the government agency? Because 8 times out of 10, if you don't know that agency and you are just by chance just responding to it, your competitors have already built those relationships. They're already known to government. They already know what their capabilities are. So it's an easier sell for them as someone who's brand new that's coming into the market who have not built any relationships. It's very hard.
And that's not about it being inappropriate at
No.
all. If we're looking at government making a purchase, they want to minimize their risk. And so if they've
Absolutely.
got a supplier who's been in there for 12 months, 2 years, 5 years doing the sort of work, then they know whether or not they're any good. They know whether they deliver on time. They know whether they deliver the quality. More importantly, they know whether or not that person actually understands us as a department. And so that's all about lowering their risk. And obviously, if there's a new one who just comes in and wants to buy the work, well, that's potentially a high-risk strategy for government to buy. Not forgetting, of course, that they'll then actually have to train up that new provider on how the department works and what its objectives are.
Absolutely. Government is risk averse. So just remember, if you are tendering, risk averse, but de-risk yourself. Don't become the supplier that's high risk. And the high risk demonstrates that you haven't read the question, you haven't demonstrated your capabilities or capacity, you haven't demonstrated the approach, you don't have all the policies and requirements that government requires.
And that's not an insignificant body of stuff. A big part of tender responses now is addressing the policy needs of government. And this has been a big deal that you've helped a number of my clients sort of sort out. And it's not something you can do in a few days before a bid's due.
No. One of the key policies that have come out probably in the last 5 to 6 years is around the social procurement and local jobs first policy. It derived probably 8 years ago, and Victorian state was the first state to embed a social procurement framework that derived from the UN about 8 years ago.
So what does that really mean?
It is about spending with your procurement. So government really is impactful, and the opportunities for you to procure to create a social impact to community, the the project and to the state. So there are 10 objectives to the social procurement framework, and everybody knows about it. They just don't understand where it comes from, but it's Indigenous spend. Like, how are you supporting Indigenous spend or Indigenous pathways? How are you supporting disadvantaged communities? How are you supporting all the marginalized cohorts? Are you providing a fair and safe workplace for women? Are you supporting regional Victoria? Are you sustainably aligned to the environment? So all those objectives that you think are just, words that have been floating around, it actually has a framework that the government works through as part of their procurement process. So any contracts that are over a certain threshold must have that element of social procurement in it. And we've helped a number of your clients actually to embed the social procurement strategy within it, because we've seen waitings on social procurement. The latest one, a couple of weeks ago, we saw 40% waiting on it.
40% of the procurement decision criteria
Was based on social
based on
procurement
social
and
procurement.
local
Wow.
jobs. Yeah. So, and that makes really good sense because, I mean, it was a government agency that builds buildings and construction. Your competitors can build, you can build. There's no differentiation because building, you've got, compliance of how to build and what to build. The strategic differentiation is the social procurement. So, from those projects that you're building, what social procurement are you creating that creates that impact on behalf of government?
Wow,
Yeah.
that's a serious waiting.
Yeah, absolutely. It used to be only 5%, and it was just a tick of the box. And unfortunately, a lot of businesses who just tick a box, who used to tick a box or do tick a box, find that in comparison to someone who has actually invested in their social procurement strategy and framework, are the ones who are more advantageous and have a strategic lever against those competitors who do not.
So if it's 40%, that must require a respondent to actually have some pretty meaty stuff.
Absolutely.
So what do they actually need to have in place
So
to
they need
actually
to have.
meet those sorts of requirements?
So, based on what the actual agency or government agency wishes to choose, because obviously they're not going to select 10 objectives as part of
No.
that project, they'll select three or four objectives that you must meet. So, it could be, 1.5% spend of that total contract on Indigenous businesses.
Right.
So, you're going to have to spend 1.5% of that $100 billion contract on Indigenous businesses. So having those social strategies in place within your procurement and building those relationships with your supply chain helps you formulate those partnerships and relationships where you can actually procure those services from those social benefit suppliers and in turn generate the support for increasing Indigenous business and creating job opportunities for Indigenous people through that mechanism. So it is not, like you said, an overnight process. It takes a while to develop that and actually implement that. So it's great that people know the why. It's demonstrating the how that you're going to do it is the most important part. There are targets that government sets for you. You've got to meet obviously the minimum, but we also always recommend that you always push yourself to do a stretch target so that you can demonstrate that you do live and breathe this as part of your organization and it's not just a tick of the box.
Yeah, what are some other examples?
Other examples is women. So women safety and equality within your workplace. So you do have to have strategies and policies in place. So a gender equality policy within your organization. So all these policies that align to that framework should already be living and breathing within your organization.
Right.
All organizations should have fair workplace, should also have gender equality policies. It's the norm. And if you don't have it, then you're one step below your competitor who have all those policies in place to protect your employee, but to also align with government as well.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of work, but it seems like once you've got it in place, then it's pretty easy to maintain and it'll be used for a range of tenders.
Absolutely. If you can think about it, not just using it for tenders, but you're living and breathing within your organization of creating opportunities for apprentices, trainees and cadets. Because, in industry at the moment, you hear a lot about, oh, but we can't find anybody to work, or we can't find any females to work. Government wants this. Well, what are you doing as an organization to create those opportunities? And it could be from grassroots, It could be working with organizations that advocate for STEM and women in that, working with the universities, with the graduates or undergraduates to build that and create those pathways for them. So there are so many opportunities to think about, and it's outside thinking outside the box of once you decide what type of organization you want to be, is how those programs are then developed to live and breathe those social impacts.
Yeah, so apart from being important from a government policy perspective, they're actually good processes to have in business anyway. And so therefore it's actually more a matter of actually being able to articulate them and take credit for the fact that they're already in place.
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've read our tender request for tender documentation carefully, and we've prepared a belt and braces response. We haven't exceeded the word limits because that way
Excellent.
the response is actually we're going to be able to be read. We've got our social procurement policies in place, and then we've got our appropriate levels of insurance and so on. And we've submitted this thing online because no longer do you need to actually feed it into a wooden box like I used to. And it's been submitted on time. What
Fabulous.
typically happens then?
So part of that then process is government will then go and evaluate. So they'll have an evaluation team. And the reason why we rely importance on how you respond is not there's not just one evaluator. They may parcel those responses up and actually divvy up the responses to experts who can assess that. So in your response, always you can always repeat things in your response so that you can actually inform the person. So one of the things that evaluators hate is going to find the information. It needs to just be then and there. So they'll do a whole evaluation process. They'll shortlist where they need to. They'll have criteria of how they evaluate, and they have a plan, a procurement plan of how they'll shortlist, whether it's the top two, whether it's the highest. So those things come into play. They'll collaborate, and then it really then is pricing. Now, pricing is rarely weighted. It is a risk assessment. One of the tips that I tell our clients is if weighting is on pricing, it is very price conscious. So you really need to think, do a bid or no bid, whether or not you are going to bid on something that's weighted in price. Pricing is very competitive.
So if they say that pricing's a criteria, then they're really looking for the lowest of the low.
Yes. Majority of the time, yes. So have a think about that. But where it's risk assessment and there's no weighted criteria, they will then look at that over the overall and make an assessment on your pricing. They've got already got a budget in mind in there, and whether or not how high risk you are in terms of the pricing, they may come back to you with clarification. Some of that clarification may come into the forms of a BAFO.
Right.
What is a BAFO?
Yeah, what's
There's lots of
BAFO?
acronyms in government. It's best and final offer.
Yeah.
And we've
And so how does that play out? I
sorry, what
mean,
was that?
we've put in a good tender. Everyone's tenders have been evaluated. I take it they probably actually ask a few questions if there's any points of clarification. And then what, you then start to re-tender again.
No re-tendering. No, it's either interviews or demonstrations, depending on the service and products. They may call you in for a demonstration of your service offering or your product offering, and then they will ask you for pricing. So whether or not you would like to do a final, give you an opportunity to actually resubmit your pricing. When they do that, they're expecting you to give them a discount. But as I recommend to our clients, you know your margins. You be firm in the pricing that you set, and it's up to you how you would like to leave government with a pricing that's going to be beneficial for you, or are you happy to reduce some of your margins to give them a lower price? And that's really depending on your organization's strategic objectives, right? I mean, we've been asked for BAFOs where I've stayed true and firm on my pricing because once it's locked in, the duration of the contract could be 3 or 4 years. And there is no CPI increases. It is, I'm factoring now and for the future. I'm not just factoring my pricing just for today.
And how much room is there to negotiate? Is there any room to negotiate, or is it just here's another letter which has got a new price in it, and that's all there is to it? There's no discussion.
There is sometimes discussion. It depends on how competitive it is, and we just can't predict what government will do with that pricing. So it just depends on the competitors and the pricing that comes through from all. I mean, they could have variations between the lowest, and there could be like a 20% margin between the highest and the lowest. What does government do? So it then goes back to, okay, well, we've evaluated you on these weighted criterias. Do we want to speak to you some more to say, hey, can you provide discounts if we gave you, 200,000 worth of work? Is there opportunity for further discounts? So they're the kind of negotiations, but absolutely, there's very limited negotiations when it comes to BAFOs on
Right.
your part.
So they're unlikely to come back to you after you've put in your best price and say, well, we've got an even better price.
No, so the once you do the BAFO, it's locked in, and then they will determine whether or not they wish to go ahead with you, or they're going to take the person who's offered a better margin.
Yeah. So, are there any real winning strategies in this? I suspect that, there's always going to be encouragement to drop the price, but there's also the risk that the contract becomes unprofitable. And then what's the point of government procuring from someone that they're going to send bankrupt?
So as I said to you, it depends on what the strategic objective of that. Of your organization. If
Yeah.
your organization is to just break even so that you've got an opportunity to showcase and demonstrate your delivery on these outputs and experience in working with them, then that's a choice that you need to make. But
Yeah.
if you're hard and firm, because you know your industry, you know your market, you know your competitors' market, because you should know what your competitors' rates are, you should come in there with a relatively competitive. The government is not industry, so you can't inflate margins and prices as you would in industry. Like I said, government is very risk adverse, and pricing plays a significant role because they are working with community funds and community money. So they've got another layer of that complexity when they're accepting pricing, to make sure that there's value for money that they're contracting to.
Yeah, but also value for money at low risk.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay, so we've gone through the BAFO process, we've been awarded the contract, and then what? We just deliver the work and get paid.
Oh no, it's then the hard part, Dom.
Yeah.
It's about contract management. It is so important. Everybody forgets the poor little cousin that I call contract management, because everybody gets excited about, we've just signed the contract. In your T's and C's, you would have signed off on this contract. So it's all about managing the expectations and making sure that you're delivering on your SLAs and the KPIs that have been set for you, but also making sure that you've delivered the outputs of what you're engaged to 100%. First contract that you get for government is a really good test for you on how you build that partnership with for longevity with government. So if you're not managing your contracts effectively, you have really pushed away the opportunity for you to be re-engaged going forward. So contract management is really important. Have a very solid process, documentation, and a reporting and compliance with embedded into your organization, because we've seen so many organizations, particularly local government of late, that the audits have always come back to say contract management is under par. It's because people don't have time, they don't have the skill sets to actually assess the contracts, but there's no monitoring and reporting compliance to it.
Are you looking to pinpoint the areas that will make the biggest impact on your business? Check out the Organisation Performance and Value Diagnostic. This powerful tool lets you evaluate your business on multiple facets and provides email reminders to keep you on track. Head over to criticalfewactions.com.au and get started now. So for the uninitiated who don't do this every day and who are entering into the government sector, what are the key elements of the contract management that you would expect them to be good at?
Knowing what the SLAs are. So, making sure that you've agreed to SLAs that are achievable. So,
Yeah.
when you sign those contracts with government and they've put stipulated some KPIs and SLAs in your contract, make sure that you understand what you are signing up for. So, once you know what they are, then it's about managing them and making sure that your team who are delivering that is true to what you've signed up for, because you'll be assessed on that. And it could be in the forms of abatements that are carried across that, and if you don't deliver, making sure that the POs are there, making sure that the contract dates are there so that you can actually start re-engaging or reinvigorating the relationship. All those things that have those trigger points and red alerts on a contract helps you inform whether or not, one, you want to partner with government in the future, two, were you able to deliver this, or three, was it an out of reach SLA that should not have been signed because you didn't read the contract?
It sounds like a hell of a lot of hell of a journey. Is it really worth it?
It's
Because
worth
there's it
it.
sounds like there's a hell of a lot of overhead in helping the government protect its backside.
What I always say to clients, because everybody says government is a cash cow, government is not for everybody. And you've got to really think about the monitoring, the reporting, and the compliance that is involved with government. I mean, government is a beast in itself. It's understanding complexities, and government is complex. It's the policies that you've got to adhere to. It's changes that you may need to make within your organization to align. And it's a costly exercise to tender. But once you have built that partnership with government, it is a very long-standing government relationship. And when you go from state, there's agencies, there's local government, at least there's that case studies that you can build on that, which then enhances your capabilities and capacity for future growth.
Yeah, and as you say, they're risk averse, and once you've proven that you're a good risk, that actually works in your favor.
Absolutely.
It doesn't give
Absolutely.
you an unfair competitive advantage, but it certainly does position you well for future work from those departments.
Absolutely, because you become known to government. And once you are known to government, you've lowered your risk.
And the departments, the different departments look at each other's suppliers. They also look at your qualifications as to which other departments they've worked for. They may do some internal reference checking, and that's all part of them appropriately reducing their risk, with the government spend.
Yes. And people don't understand this. We've got the major departments within state government, but outside of those major departments, there are so many, there's over 500 agencies that operate to support government initiatives. So when we're talking about government, there's so many layers of government that you can work with, from local to agency to state to federal.
It's vast, and their spend is huge.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Yim, what do I need to do to maximize my chances of success? If it's always going to be down to the last three-horse race, how do I maximize my chances?
One of the key levers at the moment is through your social procurement advantage. So, if you've got social procurement as an inbuilt strategy within your organization, then that is your strategic lever at the moment. And I can't emphasize that enough, because that is an enormous initiative that government has put a lot of money and time and effort into. We see, waitings increase year on year with the recent 40%. You're no different in delivering a product or service, be it, more so than another person. But at the end of the day, what is going to set you from a strategic point of view is your social procurement strategy and your targets. So living and breathing and providing those initiatives to be able to deliver on those government initiatives gives you one step ahead of your competitors.
Because that's effectively helping government deliver policy as well as procure.
Absolutely. And through these projects, that's how it's happened.
What else do you think that they need to do to maximise their success?
They need to actually understand government, know who your buyer is. So know what, if you're focusing on local government, understand how local government buys, understand thresholds, understand how their procurement works. If you're looking at agencies, understand their procurement process on how they procure, what they procure. A lot of the organizations usually do have forward procurement plans. Obviously, they don't advertise it easily enough for us to find, but on their website, you should be able to find the 12-month forward procurement plan that shows you when these procurements are coming out. So if any procurements in that 12-month fits your products and services, start thinking about what you need to do to build on those things. So, what are the evidence that you need to build and collect and create so that you are ready for that tender?
So early preparation is really important, because typically a tender's only in the marketplace for about a month, depending on the size of it, of course. If it's a massive infrastructure build, like, I don't know, a tunnel, then it might be in the marketplace for 12 months. But typically, if you're looking at services or products that they're looking for, they'll only be in the market for a month. And therefore, if you've got to pull together all those social procurement materials and demonstrate that you've got the supply chain in place, and that actually is going to be quite a stretch, while you're also trying to actually write an intelligent response to the tender.
So the social procurement strategy is probably one of the things that you would be looking at, and really having the policies within your organization already then and there. And the key thing for you is to be able to demonstrate that you live and breathe through these policies within your operations rather than ticking a box.
Get them in place straight away. You actually mentioned a magic word before, thresholds. And I'm out of touch with state government and federal government procurement processes. I haven't done it for 14 years. But tell me a bit about the thresholds.
So thresholds are spending thresholds from a state agency and local government, and it's when things kick in. So when policies kick in and when they have to be applied by. So,
What does that mean?
if you're looking at social procurement projects that are $3 million above contracts, that's when social procurement commitments and weightings occur. So if they're under the 3 million, then you don't necessarily have to have that social procurement or local jobs first element, and they don't apply. But anything above $3 million, then it does. With the regional, if it's $1 million in regional products, then that's when they kick in. So the regionals have a lower threshold because obviously it's harder to generate the contract and deliver out in regional, but they put those lower thresholds in place because one of the key things around it is supporting regional and creating opportunities for regional Victoria. And spending thresholds. So when do the spends come through of, the procurement? So understanding procurement is, if it's a $1 million project, how long do we have to keep that out in the market? It could be 2 weeks, it could be 4 weeks. If it's, $1 billion, what stages of procurement is there? It could be a two stage. Most big builds are two stage. So you've got an EOI and then you've got the actual tender. That could take 2 years. So know what they are so that you know the investment that you've got you to put into those tendering.
And are there still thresholds on the smaller spends, or to actually break up the spends on the number of people who are invited to respond? So
Not
if it's,
anymore. Oh, three quotes? Yes. So
yeah.
there is three quotes. So there is thresholds. So know which ones, which departments have the threshold for the bigger projects, how many quotes they need. Local government have a specific one that if it's a certain over, say, 150,000 in that local council, they'll need three quotes.
Yeah.
Or you can just do one quote and a point. So understanding those thresholds and the way government spends and procures is going to be helpful for you to determine whether or not government is for you.
Yeah, good. So, yeah, it's a complex landscape,
Yes.
but it's one that's not insurmountable. Otherwise, government wouldn't actually have any suppliers at
You're
all.
correct.
And you talked earlier about procurement panels. And how do the procurement panels work these days?
So the panels are there within panels. So a lot of the panels, so if we talk about construction, they have a construction supplier register. That's a pre-qualified panel. Those panels help you be pre-qualified in your compliance. So, I mean, that captures your insurances, your policies, and whatnot, so that if you get to that next stage and they see your profile and you match their profile, then you get invited to those tenders. So that's where I say, once you're on a panel, it's your ticket to the ball, but it doesn't guarantee you a dance with them, right? So the work then is then you've already invited to the ball. How are you going to be able to fill your dance card up? So that's where the relationship has to start, and being on those panels give you opportunities because you've already been selected as part of that panel, and that helps you be able to be one step ahead of someone who's not even in the panel.
Yeah, it's a very formal pre-qualification process, but it exposes you to a lot more opportunities for purchase.
But it doesn't guarantee you a contract, though. Just because
No.
you've been shortlisted on that panel and you are a supplier on that panel, the hard work begins when you are appointed on that panel. And that's when you start building the relationship. Because without the relationship, even though you're on the panel, you are still unknown to government if Joe next door is actually doing so much work in building good relationships with government.
So you're a medium business. How have you applied all this to your business, and how's this given you the best benefit in your business?
So we like to think that we live and breathe what we tell our clients. So we have all those processes in place. We establish a social procurement framework. We have those policies documented. We have targets that we set for yourself. And obviously we're a small, medium business and we don't do a lot of spend because we're a consulting, but wherever there's opportunities for us to use social benefit suppliers and creating an impact, we live and breathe that. So if things, and one of the things that government loves is local content, which means keeping it within the local onshore. We don't go offshore for any consulting work. It's all in-house. We create opportunities, and we try to create those pathways. So we live and breathe those policies and those frameworks to demonstrate that this is who we are. We are experts in it, and we are fully prepared for when opportunities of a tender response comes our way.
Fantastic.
If you really want to kick off your strategic planning and work in a supportive environment with other CEOs and leaders, the CEO Masterclass in Strategic Planning and Implementation is for you. This 10-month small group course helps you craft your strategic plan, present it to a group of peer investors, and develop a habit of monthly implementation. Our waitlist is open now at criticalfewactions.com.au.
So, Yim, if a founder or a CEO is looking to start focusing on the government market, what critical few actions should they start tomorrow if they did nothing else?
Define who they are. What is their UVP? So what is their unique value proposition, and be known for that?
Yeah.
Understand government, understand how they buy, and prepare yourself to align to government. So aligning your policies and organisation to government initiatives are the three key things that you should start today.
Yeah. And if you see a tender, read the damn thing.
Please read. The amount of times I've had clients not read it and we review it, and I have to say, why are you responding to this tender?
Yeah.
And by that time, it's so late in the piece that you just have to keep going because you've invested 3 weeks into this.
And then you're trying to retrofit.
Yeah. And it's very hard to get to ask for help in the last week of a tender when it's due.
And often very expensive.
Yes, correct. You don't want to be in that position. So please read the tender. Please make sure that you meet the mandatory requirements and address the questions.
Yeah.
A lot of people don't understand how to address the questions. Read the question. Just answer it in a very simplified form of how are you going to answer the question.
Yeah, fantastic. Yim, I'm about to go and get some counselling because it's brought back memories of hundreds of requests for tenders, requests for information. As always, it's been a delight to chat with you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, John. It's been a pleasure. Love talking about it.
Thanks for listening to the Critical Few Actions podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and grab the downloadables from the show notes. And if you found this episode helpful, I'd really appreciate it if you share it with your peers and your team. Stay focused. Take action. The Critical Few Actions podcast, including show notes and links, provides general information only and is not individualised business advice, nor can it be relied upon as such. You must take responsibility for your own advice, decisions, and actions.